Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How accurate is the history in Shakespeare's Henry IV plays? They were historic in their own right in that they appear to have been the most commercially successful of all of Shakespeare's works in his own lifetime, 200 years after the real Henry usurped the throne from Richard II. But while the actual Henry IV and his successor son Henry V led fascinating lives before and during their reigns, Shakespeare took some serious liberties in bringing their stories to the stage, changing some characters and creating others, like the unforgettable comic character of Sir John Falstaff, almost from whole cloth. Saturday night, the Dallas Theater Center opens its new season with a production of Henry IV to run through October 10th. Joining us to talk about the play, we have Kevin Moriarty, Artistic Director at the Dallas Theater Center, and Catherine McDormand, who is Associate Professor of British History at TCU. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
So clearly these plays were really popular in Shakespeare's day. How much would the audience have known about the real history when they sat down to watch the show?
They would have had a general idea of the sequence of events. Sources say that even some of the groundlings, that is the lower classes that paid just a few pennies to attend, would have had a basic idea. And of course, the theater appealed to all classes of Englishmen at that time. So you could have had some of the best educated people in the country there in the audience, and you could have had some of the least educated, but all would have had a fairly fundamental idea of the facts.
So they would not have been, would they have walked away like as happens today when people go see a movie about something that's happened in recent history and then they assume that, you know, Oliver Stone's JFK is how it happened. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of, did it calcify in that way?
I don't think so. I think Shakespeare had to rein himself in a little bit as far as arranging the facts because his audience would have a fundamental idea. I doubt if they came away with a seriously altered view of how things happen. But I think Shakespeare is after a few other points here. I think as a historian, which of course he was, that was not his primary interest, but Shakespeare was trying to challenge his audience to look at things in a different way. He wasn't just reinforcing the cultural norms. He wasn't just reinforcing the Tudor traditions of history. He may have been doing that in part to get by the censors, but he's also suggesting some new ways of looking at things. In fact, I think he's almost a modern man in many ways.
What sources, Kevin, would Shakespeare have drawn on to have his information to write the plays?
Well, the number one source would have been a book written by a writer named Holinshed, The Chronicles of England, which basically told the history of the great kings of England at the time. That book was widely read and was quite popular. The whole idea of history was relatively new at that time, the distinction between what is factually, historically true and what is mythological, for instance.
Absolutely.
And Shakespeare, you can follow in the source material, whether you're reading Holinshed's Chronicles or whether you're reading other plays written about the same historical characters that Shakespeare knew, plays that would have been performed at that time in England. You can follow what he's lifting almost scene for scene, episode by episode, versus what he is creating almost entirely from scratch.
Now, Shakespeare, of course, wrote 9 or 10 history plays, but was there anything happening at the time he was writing Henry IV that would have made this particular story seem particularly relevant to his audiences?
Well, I think that the traditional interpretation has been that because England had defeated the Spanish in the Great Armada in 1588, which is about 20 years well, about 15 years before he starts writing these plays and then producing them on the stage, the popular view is that England was just awash with nationalism and excitement. And yet at the same time, by the 1590s when he's writing them, Elizabeth is old. She is the last Tudor. She has no heirs. There is an informal understanding that the throne will go to the closest cousin she has, which is the King of Scotland. But it's not a done deal. And Elizabeth, because she was extraordinarily proud, was never going to acknowledge a successor formally. she, I guess, thought she was going to go on forever. And, of course, she did live a very long time for a person of that era. But there is an environment when these plays are being produced. On the one hand, the excitement of having defeated the Armada. On the other hand, an uncertainty about the future of what will happen when Elizabeth does die. So I think those are the circumstances.
To a large extent, I think in the history plays, you can follow two strands. In Henry IV, you can follow a political strand, which largely is concerned with the questions of what is a just ruler and how does a just ruler become and maintain their power. The trade-offs of the costs of becoming a ruler, for instance, through a revolution – and the benefits of that, presumably ruling with fairness and justice after you've caused all the damage that's necessary to become the just ruler through a revolution. The other question that the plays focus on is a much, much, much more kind of personal set of themes. And in this one, you have a young prince, a late teenager, who is going to become the king. He is going to assume the throne. And his father has one very strong set of views about what his son should be and do to be a great ruler, to be a man, to be worthy of his inheritance. And the son has a completely different view. The son is partying and drinking and thieving, robbing, breaking laws, is living with lowlifes in London rather than living in the castle and living up to the ways his dad wants him to live. So to a large extent, you have a father-son drama and a teenage rebellion drama, a prodigal son story, if you will, that is happening at the center of a play that is also concerned with these significant questions about how should one rule and what should one do to be a good ruler.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the books I was looking at said that although Henry IV, as presented by Shakespeare, is rather a dull fellow. I mean, he isn't even the center of the two plays that are titled Henry IV.
It's like Henry V, the prequel.
Exactly, exactly. And so this particular commentator said, regardless, Henry IV did two remarkable things. First of all, he took over the throne by usurpation, by revolution, as Kevin says, and yet he did not become a tyrant. And that was an accomplishment. And the second thing is, by the time Prince Hal does become Henry V, he has been battle-tested, he has been trained, and in the Middle Ages, those were two pretty remarkable things to have done because many of the problems, as you said, Chris, in the beginning, the just confusing story of the throne passing down. It was supposed to go to the oldest son, but the confusing story of the whole question of who should be king is further complicated by the fact that not only did people not reproduce properly and have just enough sons, but not too many.
And Richard II had none, who preceded
Richard
II Henry
IV. Had none. And the problem goes back to the grandfather, and that was Edward III, who had five sons live to grow up and cause problems. And of those three, we see them in juxtaposition here in Henry IV. But part of the problem was that when someone became king, like Richard II, he became king when he was a little boy, and he was dominated by his uncles all the time he was growing up. Well, by the time he could claim his own sort of majesty as a king, he was going to get back at all those who had dominated him. So part of the problem is no one was really trained to become king. And so Henry did that. Hal was really ready by the time he became king.
I was fascinated to read when I was researching this last night that although today we really see Hal as the center of the play, that in Shakespeare's day, the best actors really wanted to play Hotspur.
Yeah.
Well, Hotspur in many ways is really the heroic he's the great prince of the play. He's the character who, by the standards of Elizabethan times, would have deserved to be king in terms of his qualities. He is strong. He is decisive. He is moral. He is a valiant warrior. And he's a relatively simple figure in terms of his psychology. He pursues what he believes right with strength and a vengeance. Hal, on the other hand, is a deeply troubled character. He's charismatic, he's funny, he's witty, but he also has been thrown in jail for thieving. He is spending his times in taverns with low lives and fraternizing with – he has a significant PR problem. He's the equivalent, I guess, of, you know, the Paris Hilton of the day or something. He's – you know, the whole country is aware that the prince is a rascal and a significantly troubled youth. And though he grows into being a great warrior and ultimately a great king, that is a real struggle for him. It's not his natural born qualities. Whereas Hotspur's the great rival for the throne and against the prince, Hotspur kind of naturally carries those qualities. He would be, I guess, the valedictorian, the football captain, the kid who's groomed for political succession from his youth, whereas Hal is the rebel who just can't seem to get along with his parents or with society and yet somehow manages to mature into one of the great leaders in English history.
So we have this phenomenal line among many, but uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. What did King Henry have to worry about?
Well, of course, that comes from the second play of Henry IV.
This production, excuse me for interrupting, is both plays put together. Is that
right?
Is
we've okay. combined part one okay. and part two into a three-act evening that that moves through the whole story from the prodigal son all the way up through the redemptive, heroic, glorious moment of being crowned king.
Extravaganza? Is that too strong a word?
It is not. It is not too strong a word. There'll be sword fights and singing and lots of action and adventure and some really glorious poetry as well.
And, of course, that's what made these history plays so popular. You mentioned that earlier. They just had rip-snorting action. They had, of course, as in all Shakespeare, glorious poetry. But there is just such a excitement to these plays that you get through all the sword fights and the battles. And, of course, what's remarkable to think about is when they were done originally, they were just done in the open air with no special effects, no particular way of creating scenes. And so the audience had to simply imagine this. But for modern times, this is a very exciting production of lots of sword fights. But, you know, the thing that I'm struck with in Hotspur as I was reading him, Hotspur never lives in the present. He's either reciting grievances from the past or he's saying what he's going to do when he gets his proper vengeance for the insults that have been delivered in the past. And I was struck in reading him, and I hate to admit this, I found him tedious, you know, posturing and rather bloviating and always about, I am so aggrieved. Well, we've all known people like that, and they do wear on your nerves. And then I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. It's always in the future. And his wife, his father, everybody says, now calm down, because he is that way. Hal, on the other hand, and this is where it gets interesting, other than just a very small mention in Holinshed and a kind of, you get the feeling, circulating rumor, there's not a whole lot of real evidence that Hal ever was that badly behaved. In fact, if you start tracing him from about 1399, or even before that, when his father died in 1399, he's so busy at war trying to keep the Welsh from overrunning England, running around watching for conspiracies, you just wonder, when did he have time to get in all that trouble?
Catherine McDorman is my guest. She's Associate Professor of British History at TCU. Kevin Moriarty is also here. He's Artistic Director at the Dallas Theater Center, which this Saturday opens its new season with a production of Henry IV. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. The Dallas Theater Center opens its new season Saturday with a production of Henry IV. Here to talk about the influence of history on Shakespeare's writing are Catherine McDormand, who is Associate Professor of British History at TCU, and the director of that production and Artistic Director of Dallas Theater Center, Kevin Moriarty. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about everybody's favorite character, Sir John Falstaff. He does a lot of really terrible things, and yet we all adore him. Why is that?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that Falstaff is, as you said, is truly one of the greatest comic characters, the greatest one Shakespeare ever created, one of the greatest ones in all of Western literature. Harold Bloom, the great English literature writer, claims that Falstaff is kind of the most joyous source of inspiration and humor and a force for life in all of English language literature. That I think part of that is that Falstaff has one mode by which he lives, and that is a line he says in the play, "Give me life," and he will do anything to prolong and celebrate the pleasures of life, which includes drinking copious amounts of alcohol, having sex with a large number of women, eating immense amounts of food. He is a very, very, very large man, constantly joking around, sleeping all day, robbing people to get means to buy more food and alcohol and have more relationships with loose women. He lives totally for the pleasures of being alive. He has absolutely no moral compass by which he lives, whereas other characters in the play are going off to war for the sake of honor. Falstaff is doing everything he can to avoid war for the sense of prolonging the immediate pleasures of the flesh, for more life, more life, more life. The other thing I think that makes Falstaff so glorious in the context of the play is that he serves as a great foil to all of the political side of the play, whereas in the political side of the play, we're really concerned with a major idea is the question that a leader needs to have a political face, that how you are perceived matters as much as what you actually do. And therefore, it's very, very, very important. If the king keeps telling his son, what is vital is that you appear to be strong, that you appear to be just, that you appear to be ethical.
That's right out of Machiavelli.
And Machiavelli would have been a big influence on Elizabethan culture at the time. Elizabethans were taken, at times scandalized by Machiavelli's notions that a great leader could have a difference between their exterior and their interior. The king keeps advising his son that how you appear matters as much, if not more, as what you do. Whereas Falstaff cares not a bit about appearances. He doesn't care if you think he's a coward. He doesn't care if you think that he is a degenerate. He doesn't care if you think he's a drunkard. He constantly is made fun of for being fat. He doesn't care about any of that. What he cares about is the pleasures of the moment. And so that question about appearances versus who you really are, and that question of immediate gratification versus kind of long-term higher ends, those run throughout the play and are a great source of comic energy and also at times moving drama in the play.
Mm-hmm. Do you deal at all with Hal's rejection of him towards the end of Henry IV, Part II?
I think it's one of the saddest, most moving, complicated things in the play is that ultimately Hal, despite being a partying wild prodigal son to his – you know, who can never reconcile with his father, ultimately by the end of the journey of these two big plays, he has to grapple with the fact that now, whether he wants it or not, the crown is on his head. And the entire nation is relying on him. the choices he makes will either result in the country breaking apart and brother killing brother and a massive civil war, or it will result in a unified country where everyone marches together and at peace. And ultimately, for Hal, that means acknowledging that the greater good, all those lives, a unified, peaceful country, means he's going to have to reject the pleasures of the flesh in the immediate moment, and that means rejecting Falstaff. And that, I think, is a very moving and sad moment.
Do you think Hal really sort of understood that all along somewhere deep inside, or is it a realization that he comes to?
He says in the very beginning, I think the first time we see Hal after Falstaff, is that as Falstaff exits, Hal turns to the audience and says, in a not exactly a soliloquy, but in a thinking aloud, I'm just putting on this act of being a degenerate, because my hope is that then when I show my true leadership, the stunning contrast will be so amazing that I will be even more glorious. I find that a bit disingenuous, but okay, that's the way he justifies it. You know, and what's so interesting, Kevin, too, is I've noticed in the structure of the play, I don't know exactly how you're doing it since you're combining it, but the Hotspur scenes and the Falstaff scenes alternate. There is never a time when you get Falstaff coming on and just being so self-indulgent, and then you get Hotspur coming on and all full of virtue. And I wonder if the audience, as I did in reading it, didn't find – you kind of get through the Hotspur so you can get back to the Falstaff because it's fun. But I wonder, in a way, Shakespeare is supposed to be telling us what a fine fellow Prince Hal is. And yet all through the play, he kind of your attention is drawn elsewhere. It's drawn to Falstaff for the fun, or it's drawn to Hotspur for the declarations of courage and all of the Elizabethan virtues. But Hal is kind of, even though he's supposed to be the center of this and we're supposed to sympathize with him, what I find interesting is Shakespeare never takes a stand on whether the usurpation was justified, whether Henry IV has drawn down misfortune upon his head and his son and their family by doing this seizing of the throne. He allows everybody to speak their piece. He allows Hal to justify himself. He allows Hotspur to say how angry he is. He allows the king to justify it. But there's never any judgment rendered. And this is kind of what makes him modern, in that he shows a Falstaff who is morally, well, not centered at all, as you say. And he shows these other heroes that, if you really look even just slightly below the surface, are pretty seriously flawed.
And I think in many ways this is Shakespeare would not have been able to conceive of the idea of modern psychology. That would have been foreign to Elizabethans. But the history plays seem to have liberated him as a writer to really create an almost modern form of dramaturgy or playwriting that is very easy to read psychologically now as 21st century readers or theater artists, because what exactly as Catherine said, he has characters who we know are ultimately going to make certain choices. We know that this young reprobate prince is going to become one of England's greatest heroic warrior kings, who unifies the country and heroically leads everyone to battle against France, which is England's favorite pastime throughout history.
Yes.
For the most part, is fighting and defeating the French. So we know we have this character who's going to become – everyone in the audience would know when they go to see this play that this kid is going to – I guess it would be like seeing – a King Arthur story that starts with the sword and the stone moments from the Disney cartoon or the Once and Future King, the first half of the Once and Future King, where you have – or for that matter, those of us who like Star Wars, where you see Episode 4, the first Star Wars movie, where when we first meet Luke Skywalker, he is essentially a kind of lost kid in the middle of nowhere. Well, now if you come to Star Wars as a modern audience member, even for the first time, what you know is that lost kid in the middle of nowhere is going to grow into one of the great heroes of the Star Wars universe. So knowing where the character is going to end, it allowed Shakespeare the freedom to allow him to do almost anything before then. And that results in a character who can be heroic and moral and care about others, but who can also be at times selfish, at times very funny, at times very immature, and definitely an out-of-control party boy at times.
And don't you think that's what gives Shakespeare his timelessness, is that he deals with human complexity? He doesn't make moral judgments. He doesn't have, even though Falstaff, as we were talking about earlier, comes from stock characters from the past, from Roman and Greek classical drama, even so, he infuses him with a life that is far more complex than just being a symbol of vice. And so this is what, when you talk about Shakespeare as a historian, I think this is why he's so modern, because he allows opposites to exist without trying to resolve the opposition. He allows characters to be one of the Shakespearean plays that says the mix within the person, and he rejects all notions which were very popular at the time. It's all providence, it's all fate. The Tudors believed this, and Shakespeare, I think, in Julius Caesar says it best. It's not, the problem does not lie with the stars, with providence. The problem lies within ourselves. And so I think that's one of the things that makes him so modern and makes him such an interesting, not just playwright, but historian of the time, is he allows these characters full life.
And I think in many ways this is how an issue we deal with our modern leaders as well. Mm-hmm. We now have Supreme Court justices, presidents of the United States from both parties in the last 2 decades, many leaders in American political life who, what we know now about their youth is that their teenage years or college years included drug use or extreme partying or other moments where their family or society or parents were concerned about their ability to grow into kind of responsible manhood.
And yet we're still scandalized by that somehow. Mm-hmm.
Well, because I guess there is something about us that wants leaders. This is where Machiavelli comes in, and this is where the king, Hal's father, what he keeps saying to Hal is, hey, what people want is what people who are led, the citizens want, is a leader who is strong, who is confident, who is moral, who is pure, because it gives us the confidence that all will be well, that there will be peace, that there will be strength, that there will be prosperity. And that's, of course, what the citizens care about, all of those good virtues. But that's not the same thing as the interior life of the people who are charged with creating that world that is prosperous and peaceful and strong. The interior life of those people, you know, adolescence is adolescence. And, you know, whether you're destined to be a great leader or, you know, a drunk on the side of the road, you have a time period in your life where father-son relationships are complicated and where defining yourself as either the same or very different from your parents is essential. And those moments are tumultuous in life and often also some of the most joyful, most intense memories of our lives. We look back at those younger years with great, you know, fondness, but also probably moments of horror at the values we lived by or the behavior we did.
Well, let's talk about this. We know so little about Shakespeare's personal life, particularly his early life. We know his dad was a glove maker. The argument has been made many times, perhaps in the absence of actual information, that Shakespeare must have had daddy issues. What do you all think about that?
Well, in the absence of real information, of course, we can read him any number of ways. Again, that's what makes him so modern, are all the ambiguities that he presents in his characters and that he himself may have indeed had. I'd like to go back to something Kevin said, if I might. I think one of the interesting things when Henry IV is lecturing his son about you've got to be a peer, the strong ruler, no one ever saw the king. I mean, how many people in the course of their lives would ever expect to see any of these people? We are so inundated now with images of our leaders. They're just with us 24 hours a day. And yet then no one ever saw them. So it's an interesting thing to ponder. How exactly did Henry IV want Hal to get the message across that he was a great leader when the chances of too many people seeing him were pretty slim.
Well, interestingly enough, Henry IV Part II, the sequel that was written 2 years after the first part, begins with an allegorical character who walks out on the stage and gives a speech. The character is Rumor.
Yes.
And it's just this one moment, and the character walks out and says, "My name is Rumor, and here's what I do." And then proceeds to basically say that an event happens, whether that's something scandalous or shocking or political or personal, and then Rumor spreads it throughout the countryside, and in doing so distorts it and changes it, but has immense power over everyone who receives it. So I think, of course, now in a modern technological age, we have perhaps a more accurate and more detailed portrait of the celebrities of our time, the high-profile people in their teens and 20s. But certainly at the time, a crown prince's behavior would have been of immense interest to
source
everyone in the country.
Yeah.
It just
yeah.
would not have been necessarily firsthand.
Well, we have a great email here from Jan who writes, "To what extent do you believe Hal's embarrassing behavior in public is intended as a punishment for his father?"
Interesting point. I don't know that the Shakespearean world would have interpreted it that way. I think that they would have seen Hal killed or suffering, or Henry suffering. I think it would have been far more dramatic than just Hal's bad behavior. Because with bad behavior, as Kevin says, there's always the possibility good behavior can follow. You can learn your lessons. But it's an interesting question to ponder. I don't know that I've ever thought about Hal as or his behavior as punishment, but you do get Henry carrying on a good bit about, "I wish Hotspur were my son because he has all the virtues. He may be boring as I'll get out, but he has all the virtues I'd like to see." And, you know, it brings me back to your point, Chris, about where is Shakespeare creating out of his own issues? And, of course, being 21st century people, we think, well, of course. I mean, he's writing – we're all the Freud and the post-Freud generation.
Rewriting our own life story.
Exactly. That's what we're doing. And, of course, no one writes a play or a book or a poem without some purpose. But I don't know that – we don't know enough about his life to really make that assertion. But it's – again, like your listener's question, it's an interesting point.
We're speaking about the balance of fact and fiction in Shakespeare's Henry IV. A production of it opens Saturday at the Dallas Theater Center and runs through October 10th. Kevin Moriarty is director of that production. He's here with us. Also, Catherine McDormand, who's associate professor of British history at TCU. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Kevin Moriarty, who is Artistic Director of the Dallas Theater Center, and Catherine McDormand, Associate Professor of British History at TCU. The Dallas Theater Center's production of Henry IV opens Saturday and runs through October 10th. If you want to be part of the conversation, join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Do you know... Did Shakespeare create the character of Falstaff with a particular actor in mind?
I don't think we definitively know that, but we have reason to believe that the same actor who created the role of Bottom several years earlier in Midsummer Night's Dream, one of Shakespeare's great comic actors, Will Kemp would have been his name, that he would have also been the actor who played Falstaff. And as the later plays developed, there's reason to believe that Will Kemp left Shakespeare's acting company over the course of Shakespeare's career, and that the comic roles with that kind of vivacity and joy and muscularity start to diminish in the latter part of Shakespeare's writing as the plays become darker. There's reason to believe that the leading actor, the best actor who remained in the company, was a great tragic actor who those late great tragic roles would have been created for. So the interplay of actor and playwright, as much as we can ascertain, was intimate, as well as the fact that Shakespeare would have acted in these plays himself as well.
Yeah.
Where I'm going with it, you've made a really interesting decision against at least physical type in the actor that you chose to play Falstaff. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, Randy Moore, who is a great legendary actor here in the Dallas theater community, is returning to Dallas. He's been away for 15 years acting professionally at the Denver Center. But he's been he was a founding company member at Dallas Theater Center. He was on the stage at Dallas Theater Center from the late 1950s all the way up into the 90s. He's a great, great comic actor as well as a great classical actor. And the opportunity to have someone who can bring that much life and energy and joy and specificity with the language and creativity to a role that demands all of those things was too much to pass up. Having said that, Randy himself is a somewhat thin and even angular actor. And Falstaff is not only very, very large, but he's very round in every way. That is not, however, a creative choice on our part in terms of the way he will appear using makeup and false beards and padding and all of that. Randy will hopefully believably appear to be a very large, corpulent character, even though in real life he's definitely not.
So sort of mall Santa fat is what we should expect.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, Chris, there have been commentators that have said that Shakespeare's intent in making Falstaff so fat is also – now, I'm a little wary of making this statement too strongly, but it's social commentary because most people of that era could not have been fat. They did not have enough money, enough food. And you remember where Hal finds the list of his meal, the bill? The 26 pence that covered nothing but the gravy on Falstaff's meal – would have represented about, well, let's see, a worker earned about 4 pence a day. So it would have been, what, a week's worth of a person's wages that would have paid merely for Falstaff's gravy.
Well, that sounds like judgment there. You said earlier that he makes no judgment.
No, but he doesn't. I mean, you don't ever find Falstaff saying, you know, well, Sir John, or rather, you don't find Shakespeare saying, now, Sir John, you are being punished because you're fat. He is, as Kevin has said so convincingly, rather than that, he is this figure of great joy and energy and fun and life-loving. And, you know, when you compare him to some of these real serious soldiers, you have to say he was more of a modern sensibility than some of these folks who just, I got to go fight just to fight. Falstaff said, oh, for heaven's sakes, you know, let's make love, let's drink wine, let's have fun. And so I don't think it's Shakespeare's judging. I think he's simply offering up this character that the groundlings would have caught very quickly. This is a very wealthy man. This is an indulgent man because I could never be fat. I could never have enough money for 26 pence worth of gravy. But it isn't serious. It isn't pounded at you.
Well, and he's also, just to be clear, he's a very, very lazy man. Not only is he eating a large amount of gravy and drinking copious amounts of alcohol, but he doesn't work at all. He sleeps all day and parties all night. That's all in the text. And the way he affords to purchase the gravy or the alcohol and all the rest is through stealing. Mm-hmm. So it's the notion, whether it's to the appealing notion, whether to hardworking groundlings in Elizabethan England or contemporary audience today, the appealing notion of what would happen if I dropped out of all the responsibilities of life? Mm-hmm. What if I didn't actually have to chose not to go to work every day and live by kind of austere moral codes so that I'm physically healthy and morally strong? What if instead I actually simply slept all day, partied all night, and when I needed money to fund that, just went out and took it from somewhere? And there is something that is very, very appealing about that notion.
But Falstaff knows what the risks are. Have you noticed how often he puns on or just absolutely comes right out and says the word hanging? He knows, because crimes against property were considered just as serious as crimes against people in Elizabethan England. I mean, you could steal a sheep and be hanged. And Falstaff knew, if you see some of his speeches through that planning of the Gad's Hill robbery and all that, the word hanging, and he puns, he plays with it. But that, I think, in a contemporary audience would have also made the point that he's risky behavior here.
Well, and to be clear, he's, of course, in a play that I read largely as a father-son play, this teenage party boy has two great father figures. Mm-hmm. His birth father, as it were, the King of England, who strongly believes that appearances matter as much as anything and that a strict moral code is how one should live, even if that's through personal deprivation, through depriving yourself, rather, of personal joys. And Falstaff, his adopted father, or his father of choice, who argues that the pleasures of the moment are how one should live. Now, in the history that Shakespeare knew of the real Prince Hal, there were brief mentions of this, and he puts this into his play, that the actual prince, crown prince, was thrown in jail, was imprisoned for thievery, for theft. Now, I'll just stop and think about this for a minute. If Prince Harry or Prince William today were thrown into jail in modern day London, that would for theft after a night of partying out at the clubs, that would be front page news on every British
Twitter servers would melt down. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And then one of the reasons why is because, can you imagine someone with that level of kind of irresponsibility ascending to the most powerful leadership position in the world? And that's what the Elizabethans were looking at when they looked at this character.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Anne with us in Arlington. Hi, Anne.
Yes. I was just wondering what your guests felt. I'd always been led to believe that the value of Prince Hal's associating with the likes of Falstaff and his group, and even the common people in the pubs, was that when he did eventually assume the throne, he would know his people, the common people, as a monarch ordinarily would never have an opportunity to know them.
Yeah, people actually have seen Hal, and he's seen them.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think Shakespeare develops this even more in the next play, Henry V,
yes,
where we see Hal not as a prince but as a leader, where you really get the sense that he is able to move comfortably and confidently amongst all the social strata, especially of the armed forces. He can easily relate to the common people who are the soldiers, as well as lead the leaders of the various important families who he has to have on his side, or else he'll have a revolution. And I think that idea, that which was a relatively modern and new idea, that a leader would need to be able to appeal directly to and with all of the citizens in order to maintain their power and to be worthy of that responsibility. That was a relatively new idea, and I think Henry V, especially in Shakespeare's play, is really credited with living that. We have this, again, if you think of the modern English monarchy, this came up, for instance, when Princess Diana's death happened, and there was an immense pressure building in England at the time to encourage the Queen and Prince Charles both to step forward and share some sense of empathy or understanding for how the common people felt about the loss of Princess Diana. And from what we know of modern history, it took Tony Blair to kind of go directly to the Queen and say, you have to relate to the people or the monarchy itself is in genuine danger. I think that idea you can see in kind of Hal's embracing of all strata of class and of human life.
And it makes sense at a time when there was so much insurrection from all corners of the country.
But of course, the insurrection was largely from his aristocrats, the king's peers, the nobles. The common people were really, other than being sort of brought up, as Falstaff said, which is an anachronism. We know they didn't have pistols in 1400, but Shakespeare's day did. And so he has Falstaff go on and on about, well, these lads look scrawny and poor, but they're good enough to be gunpowder fodder. And, of course, they didn't really use it back in Falstaff's
day. Would poor people have been mustered as soldiers, or was it the sons
yes.
of noblemen?
They would have been for the ground soldiers. Now, the armed knights and all of that would have been taken from the peerage. But, you know, that's such an interesting point, and I see the way your Kevin's comments and your caller's comment also lead me to think about two things. One is Shakespeare had a very diverse audience. We talked about it first. And by including all of these different kinds of people, he, in his play, he appeals to all of the different kinds of people. The other thing is, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but isn't it before the Battle of Agincourt that Henry V slips around and listens to the soldiers the night before the battle, and he puts a cloak over his head and kind of slips around and listens to the conversation of the common folk before they go into battle? And this, I think, would not have been the normal thing that a medieval king would have done. Their idea would have been, well, let's have dinner and a glass of wine with my generals and go to bed and get up and fight in the morning. But we see Hal, as he is then Henry V, troubled, roaming in the night, listening to the soldiers. And it may well go back to that point.
I think Catherine's right to bring that moment up. And again, it's just amazing to me how the personal and the political interplay so beautifully in this play and why it's such a great work of English literature. You know, one of the values that we really have for our leaders is not only do we want them to be better than us, stronger, more moral, more confident, but we also want them to have empathy. And when we have a president, for instance, at a time of hardship in the nation, one of the things that that commentators and the voters often look for is, does the president understand people like me? Does he understand normal people's concerns, or is he isolated in Washington and doesn't understand, you know, the kind of question that you can ask a candidate, you know, where you say, well, what's the price of a gallon of milk? And if they don't know, then you think, well, maybe they're not living in the real world. They don't relate to us. And certainly that's one of the ideas that comes up loud and clear, is that part of what makes Hal a great leader is that he's truly lived a complicated real life among very complicated real people, not just isolated with the nobility. Now, the flip side of that, though, which is the personal as compared to the political side, is that chicken and egg question, which we've already chatted some about and the caller mentioned, which is this conscious on Hal's part in advance? Does he, if you want to grow up to be president, does that mean as a teenager what you should do is spend a lot of time with low lives and drunkards and have some kind of wild days so that you can grow past that and learn from it? Or is it actually that he's rebelling against his father, intending to hurt his father, working through complicated issues, running away from the responsibilities of leadership, running toward a life of constant pleasure and refusing to accept responsibility? I guess that would be the Peter Pan syndrome. You're never wanting to grow up. And then when forced to grow up, luckily is able to move past those moments but still draw on them as a source of strength. That's a question that not only do we not know the answer to about the fictional character of Hal or the historical character, but we also, you know, that's true probably in all of us as real life people who grow up to become responsible adults, is that question of did we know all along we were going to be responsible, or is it just a miracle that somehow we were able
lucky.
To shed our paths and move forward?
Exactly. Well, and you know, too.
We just have about 5 seconds left.
Oh, okay. you go ahead and speak.
All right. Yeah. The production at the Dallas Theater Center of Henry IV opens Saturday and runs through October 10th. We've been speaking this hour with Artistic Director Kevin Moriarty and Catherine McDorman, who is Associate Professor of British History at TCU. It's been great to have both of you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.